Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you, as always, for joining me for another trip down memory lane as we rip open a 85 top cello pack this week. And I normally enjoy opening any cards, and even when I was a kid, it didn't really matter what came out of the pack. I was always happy just to have baseball cards. But I'll be upfront and honest, this was a real dud of a packet. If you didn't watch the video link, which we put out yesterday on YouTube, and you can find the link on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, or if you go to YouTube, just type Wax Ecstatic 85 Tops and you'll find it. But we had some all-star cards, literal all-star cards, the all-star branded cards from 85, Mike Schmidt. Who else did we have? Eddie Murray was in there too. Ryan Sandberg, who was on the top of the pack. And we also had an all-star slash Hall of Fame worthy player, Jack Morris. His base card was in there as well. But we had not one, not two, not three, not four, but five dreaded manager cards. Five! So we move past the record that was set with our 83 top cello pack opening a few weeks ago where we had three of them. But yeah, we got five, although one of them is an interesting one. Rod Dedeaux, who was not only the manager of the United States Olympic team at the 84 games in Los Angeles, but longtime coach and manager of the USC Trojans, positively affected a lot of great players in the game, passed away back in 2006. So we'll talk about that one not as dreaded manager card and tell you a little more about Rod Dedeaux. Also a few of the other interesting finds in that pack, a little bit about the 85 top set as well. And yes, we are going to talk a lot about the Hall of Fame. It was a topic that was brought up by one of our listeners, and I blame it all on you, Doug McCready. No, it was a topic, of course, everyone's talking about. Harold Bain, should he be in the Hall of Fame or not? And because he was elected by the Veterans Committee, never got into the double digits through the Baseball Writers Association, should he even be in there? And it was a curious topic that I was kind of on the sidelines about earlier, quite honestly. I don't know why so many people are extremely, ridiculously angry. But I was kind of on the sidelines. I had my own thoughts about it. Didn't really care to share it with anybody. And then Doug asked the question and I responded, and that started the old poop storm. And I will give you my full explanation as to why I'm not all that upset about Harold Baines being in the Hall of Fame. And it's partially because of Tim Raines being in the Hall of Fame, but also it is part of those who are hoping for other players from the today's game generation, if you will, of the Veterans Committee. And that is the portion of the Veterans Committee that focuses on players who retired after the 1988 season. Actually, I think it's inclusive of the 88 season, but basically any player whose career ended within the past 30 years, they get looked at by the Veterans Committee if they don't make it through the Baseball Writers Association vote. And there are a lot of players who I think are deserved of Hall of Fame status. We've talked about them before. And if you want some of these other players to get into the Hall of Fame, then I think you need to take it a little easy on Harold Baines. And by the way, congratulations to Harold Baines and Lee Smith for getting inducted through the Today's Game Committee with the Hall of Fame just this past week. And then, of course, in just a couple weeks from now, we'll know who the Baseball Writers Association did get in. And I've had an interesting conversation with other people about that ballot as well. And that's something we'll address a little later on the show, too. But first, I want to do the usual housekeeping. If this is the first time you're listening to Wax Ecstatic, well, what took you so long? No, welcome to the program. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and I'm glad to go through the old boxes and the binders of baseball cards. We've been doing this off and on for almost 3 years now. Yeah, it's been about 2.5 years. Took a little break earlier this year, came back this summer, and we produce these shows every other Friday during the off season. So our next show will be coming your way on Friday, December the 28th. And it is Christmas week, so we'll have perhaps some Christmas goodies to share with you. And also, I'll be attending our local card show again this upcoming weekend, actually. So hopefully we can find some glorious old packs that we can open up through there. So if we do find something, we'll share it on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains earlier on in the week. Now, Monday of that week is Christmas Eve, so perhaps we'll wait until Wednesday. But just keep following us at Wax and Gum Stains, and you'll see that. But the show comes out every Friday, or every other Friday, rather, via Audio Boom, also our other various channels, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify. And if you're technical and technically savvy, you already know that there's numerous other ways that those feeds get out there. But whatever way you do listen to us, we certainly appreciate it. And we would appreciate you passing along the word that Wax Ecstatic is up and running throughout the off season. And we are rummaging through the baseball cards that you once collected or perhaps still collect. And we've got a lot of great discussions, a lot of great memories, and even the old controversy every now and then with things such as Hall of Fame ballots. Now, we are also, I wouldn't say a charity organization, but we do certainly appreciate any donations you can make to help keep Wax Ecstatic alive and well. And you can make a donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that is paypal.me/waxecstatic. And we've already received some donations over the last couple of weeks. Certainly thank everybody who has made a donation. Doesn't have to be big. Can literally be $2, $3, $4, you know, just some pocket change. Or if you've got a little more, you got 20 or 30 bucks you want to donate, that is great as well. A reminder that every donation goes right back into the program. None of this money just goes into my back pocket and that's it. This program is sponsored and supported through listeners at the moment, and your money helps us maintain the home base at audioboom.com, as well as all the archives from all of the 100-plus shows that we've done so far. And also, it goes to the purchase of packs. We do like to rip open packs and talk about the cards inside. And I try to keep it as fresh as possible. I don't want to be repetitive. Granted, this show was based on the quote-unquote junk wax era. You know, when we first started, we went from 1981 through 1993. So you may see a few of those packs returning at some point in time. But if we do get enough donations and I can find the right deal, if I can pull that gem of a pack from the late 70s, or if I can find some harder-to-find packs, you know, 82, 83, top cellos, stuff like that, you know, that perhaps you have the big rookie card or Hall of Fame cards, then we certainly try to do that with the donations that come along. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. That is the best way to donate a couple bucks. And again, if you've already donated, thank you. If you're considering, it doesn't have to be a big amount. Again, it could just be a few dollars. It could be a few more. And we certainly thank you for your support. And we also thank you for your commentary at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, which is up 24/7. A lot of fans, when I posted a picture of the 85 top cello pack, a lot of fans liked it. Although Rob B says, no, it has Rhino on the front. Keep it sealed. Well, Rob, the story behind this pack is when I would have several packs up there for listeners to select, which one do we open this week? The 85 tops one, even with the Ryan Sandberg All-Star card right there on top, always got overlooked. Always. It could never win the election. It either finished second or just in third in some. And rather than posting up several to choose from or trying to, you know, find another pack here, I just said, you know what? I'm finally just going to open this damn thing up myself because it's never going to win a vote unless I put it up against a pack of 90 Donruss and 91 Fleer. The 85 tops was always the bridesmaid, unfortunately. So we opened it up. And like I said, had some real clunker cards in there, but some real interesting ones too. We'll get into the details of that in just a few minutes. But first, let's settle the debate, or maybe add some more fire to the debate, whichever way you look at it. It all started with a question from a very loyal listener of ours, Doug McCready, who always has some very interesting questions, comments, and takes on everything. And I thank you for your participation, Doug. The question came in, let me see, it was this past Monday. He said, what is your take on the Hall of Fame inductees? Baines is such a head scratcher. Makes no sense. I can think of 25 players more worthy. So, you know, first of all, just on that question there, I do agree. There are a lot of other players who are, I won't say more worthy than Baines, but I think the better way to look at it is they're in the same boat as Harold Baines. And I'll explain that a little more in just a bit. But my first response, which was rather snarky, I have to admit, but if you've ever listened to this program, you know I am rather snarky. I said, well, career 294 hitter, 980 RBI, 2,605 hits, seven-time All-Star. Oh, wait, that's Tim Raines. I've got no problem with that. And that started all sorts of reactions, mostly people just upset that I would desecrate the name of Tim Raines to defend my decision that I'm not all that upset about Harold Baines being in the Hall of Fame. So first thoughts out of the gate is, everybody, calm down. Please. Do it together with me. Ready? Breathe. Relax. It's okay. Look at the news. There's so many other things to be outraged about. Harold Baines getting into Cooperstown does not destroy my home, does not empty out my bank account, does not harm my kids, does not cause me to lose sleep at night. It probably doesn't do that to you. So let's perspective, okay? It's a fun topic to debate. It happens every year. You're always talking about, you know, whether it's Hall of Fame or you know, an MVP vote or Cy Young. You know, we saw that here in Tampa Bay with Blake Snell getting the Cy Young and, you know, people thinking, well, once again, Justin Verlander got screwed. But, you know, it's debate stuff. But within reason, let's just relax here. And then the second thing is, and I actually did this in my many strings of arguments at Wax and Gum Stains, we are talking about Harold Baines. We're not talking about Wally Whitehurst. And that's with all due respect to Wally Whitehurst, who played far more games in Major League Baseball than I ever did. But you know what I'm getting to. You know, take your average ball player, somebody who had maybe 3-4 years, maybe even an overhyped, overrated rookie who fizzled out after a few years. You know, you think of the Eddie Zoskys of the world, okay? They're certainly not worthy of Hall of Fame status. Harold Baines was a pretty darn good player in his career. So, you know, it's not like we're talking about, and, you know, we've seen this in other leagues, talk about players or coaches or members of management or commissioners who get inducted into Hall of Fames, and you're going, well, that's kind of fishy. You know, like to me, Bud Selig getting into the Hall of Fame, that is extremely suspicious. You know, a lot of good things happened for Major League Baseball during Bud's, what, 25-year run as commissioner. But there was also a lot of really crappy things that happened. And, you know, it's almost like a favor being done to an elderly statesman. And that's, again, you know, I have nothing personal against Bud Selig or anything that he touched along the way. But, you know, you look at Bud Selig going into the Hall of Fame, you go, okay. And especially when somebody who was really, really influential in the game for good and bad, such as Marvin Miller, God rest his soul, is still not in the Hall of Fame. That is, to me, a bigger outrage. You know, every ball player, and every ball player who's played in the big leagues for the last 50-plus years owes Marvin Miller a debt of gratitude, because we're not talking about $20 million and $30 million a year deals. We're not talking about Troy Tulowitzki getting paid, what, $38 million to go away by the Blue Jays. And, you know, we're not talking about free agency. We're not talking about the rights that players have now from a legal and financial and contractual stance. If it wasn't for Marvin Miller and some key players early on, you know, Don Drysdale, Sandy Koufax holding out prior to the 1966 season, Curt Flood, everything he went through, you know, a lot of players paid the price to lay the groundwork for today's superstars. And, you know, I think Marvin Miller was much more influential, again, some good, some bad, than Bud Selig. So, you know, that's an argument for another time. But that's my point. You can sit there and nitpick about certain players or builders, as they're known, like in the Hockey Hall of Fame, and you can go, really, this person? But, you know, Harold Baines was pretty good. So let's calm down here. Now, I know what the next argument is. Well, Matt, it's the Hall of Fame, not the Pretty Good Hall. And you're absolutely right. The Hall of Fame for any sport should be held to the players who were at the highest standards. Now, if you are going to limit it just to the best of the best of the best, well, guess what? The Baseball Hall of Fame is probably 60% of what it is now. And especially if you go by the old stat benchmarks, which, and this was not that long ago, you're talking maybe about 20, 25 years ago, 3,000 hits, 400 home runs. If you were a pitcher, 300 wins, 3,000 strikeouts. If you were a relief pitcher, a closer, 300 saves. Those were the benchmarks that over time kind of marked, okay, is this a Hall of Fame worthy player or not? And even with those benchmarks, there are plenty of outstanding players who are still not in the Hall. How you doing, Fred McGriff? So when you look at those standards and you still see some very good players who crossed over one of those benchmarks yet are still not in, or players, and I'll use Harold Baines as an example, who came pretty darn close. He had 2,866 hits and 384 home runs in his career. Pretty darn close. You know, that's somebody that, all right, so he didn't cross the line on some of these benchmarks, but boy, he got so close, and he had a very lengthy career, you know, 22 years in the big leagues. Played with some teams that were, you know, a little off the radar, you know, it was with Texas in the early 90s, part of the Sammy Sosa trade, by the way, you know, with some bad Baltimore teams in the late 90s, and that was after he was with some good Baltimore teams in the early to mid 90s. So, you know, when you look at his career as a whole, let's, you know, dial back the outrage a little bit here. When you look at it, Harold Baines was good enough to play 22 years, have almost 3,000 hits, almost 400 home runs, was an all-star, let me see here, six times in his career, Silver Slugger once in his career, was in the MVP voting for several times early in his career in Chicago. Wasn't like a top three guy, but at least got votes. You know, he was in the top 20 for those 4 years, top 10 a couple times in 1983 and 85. So again, let's kind of dial back the outrage here, all right? It's Harold Baines. It's not Hensley Mullins. Okay, it's not Eddie Zosky, it's not Todd Van Poppel. Name any other dud. You know, Kevin Moss, we talked about him in the last podcast. You know, it's not one of those overhyped rookies who's given a pass here. Or even, and I was having this discussion with one of our listeners, not even a player like Vida Blue. You know, Vida Blue was an MVP, a Cy Young Award winner, World Series winner, won over 200 games in his career. But really, when you look at his career, and I'm not talking wins and losses, because he was also the only, and I mean only, decent player for the Athletics in the late 70s after Charlie Finley blew the team up. But, you know, once you get from basically the 70s, and he had a couple good seasons in the early 80s with the Giants, but really, once you get past the first 10 years of his career, the final, like, 5 years were, to put it nicely, rough, both on and off the field. So, yeah, you know, Vita Blue was a vital part of what the Oakland Athletics did in the early 70s. But I don't think he's Hall of Fame worthy. He had a really good stretch of years, but if Vita Blue is getting into the Hall of Fame, then we're talking about, okay, you know, what are we doing here? So again, just some perspective here. Let's just kind of calm down here. You look at the entirety of Harold Baines' career, and it's hard to argue that he at least shouldn't have been in the consideration. Now, I know there's some people going, well, the Baseball Writers Association didn't vote him in. Well, yeah, in fact, he didn't ballot very well, single digits all years that he was eligible, and he did fall under the 5% threshold. And I've got some thoughts on that, too. One is that, you know, Harold Baines was up for Hall of Fame candidacy starting in, I think it was 2007. You know, you're right in the thick of the fallout from the steroid era going on here. So it's very similar to Fred McGriff, you know, a guy who had 493 home runs. When you've got Barry Bonds, you know, clobbering Hank Aaron's home run record, and you've got, you know, the allegations around Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, and Rafael Palmeiro, and then let's not forget the pitchers, too. You know, Roger Clemens and Andy Pettit and all those guys. You know, I think it's very easy to lose sight of how consistent of a player Harold Baines was over his career. You know, this is a guy, according to baseballreference.com, in a 162-game season, he would have averaged a .289 batting average, 22 home runs, 93 RBI, you know, pretty steady throughout his career. So it's very easy to overlook that when he was first eligible. And also, as I mentioned before, he was on some teams that were pretty average and some that were downright terrible. But he was also a part of some pretty good teams too. You know, he's a member of the A's back in 1990 and 91 and 92, part of the White Sox team that went to the playoffs in 1983, part of the Baltimore Orioles teams that were consistently in the playoffs, kept running into the Yankees every year in the mid 90s. So it's not like this guy was just chopped liver, you know, just a throw-in to any kind of acquisition. Teams sought him out because he was still a pretty consistent bat. And, you know, he was able to provide some offense. And yes, I know that's also part of the argument, too. Well, he was a designated hitter. More on that in just a moment. But first, let me talk about why I brought up Tim Raines. So I gave you the numbers of Harold Baines. Here's Tim Raines' career numbers here. He played 23 seasons, 2,502 games, had 2,605 hits, as I brought up. Let's see, 980 RBI, 808 stolen bases. You know, that's certainly worthy, and a career batting average of .294. So when you're looking just at the raw numbers, essentially, with the exception of the stolen bases, because Baines was more of a cleanup hitter than a leadoff hitter like Raines was, but very similar. And I know there's other stats that will give Raines the edge. There's other stats that will give Baines the edge. And I was even accused in one exchange on Twitter, well, you're taking certain stats and, you know, putting them out there as to why Baines is better than Raines. Well, first of all, I'm not saying Baines is better than Raines. Second, the whole point of having a debate is to take factual information that helps support your cause. And that also opens up a wider conversation, and that is the Hall of Fame not big enough for two similar players who played in different roles? So Baines and Raines may have roughly the same number of hits. They may have roughly the same number of RBI. They may have roughly the same batting average throughout the years. But should we only allow one and not the other just because one was beloved and one was maybe a little under the radar or not the star player for some of the teams that he played on? You know, you look at those Oakland teams and the Orioles teams in the 90s. Harold Baines was not the number one guy on either of those. And you could argue he wasn't even number two or number three or number four in a popularity contest. But is the Hall of Fame too exclusive to where we can't have two similar players in the hall at the same time? Okay, they got there in different fashions. Tim Raines on one of his last ballots through a very popular public relations campaign, and the soft hearts of Montreal Expos fans everywhere got in through the baseball writer's vote, while Baines gets in, granted, bare minimum, but still gets in with the today's game veterans vote. Is there, really an issue here that we can't get these two together? By the way, Baines and Raines, other than having rhyming names, which is kind of neat, almost twice were teammates, almost played for the White Sox twice in their careers, but I digress. So anyways, we had all sorts of arguments going back and forth. Raines was a leadoff guy, and Baines was, a cleanup guy, and Baines, doesn't live up to this advanced statistic, and Raines has more of this advanced statistic. And I get your argument there, too. But again, you look at their careers as a whole. What is the biggest thing that separates Tim Raines and Harold Baines when you look at the overall numbers? And not just regular old school statistics, but also advanced statistics. Tell me, what is the biggest reason where you go, aha, Tim Raines has to be in. Harold Baines, screw him. I'm not seeing it. Maybe you are, but I'm not seeing it. So I just feel that Harold Baines is in the same boat. I'm not saying he's better, not saying he's worse. I think he's in the same pool of players who had outstanding careers, had great moments in their careers, had great stretches in their careers, came very, very close to some of the old guard benchmarks in terms of hits, home runs, again, for pitchers, if you're a starter, wins, if you're a reliever, saves. There's a lot of players in that boat who are not in the Hall of Fame. But because Tim Raines is, I think Harold Baines should be in there as well. And that really goes to the crux of my argument. And I said this, we did a podcast on 89 Tops back in the summer of 2017. It was shortly after Tim Raines was inducted, or I think right before Tim Raines was inducted into the Hall of Fame. And I said that I have nothing against Tim Raines being in the Hall of Fame. God bless him. Congratulations. Good for him. But I said in that podcast then, and a year and a half later, I still say it now, when you vote in a player like Tim Raines, you open up the slippery slope of guys who had really, really, really good careers, but aren't quite at the level of the no-brainer Hall of Famers. And I said that then with a word of caution that while it's good for the players who are kind of on the bubble, like Raines was for many years, it does open the door a little bit to where you're letting in, I don't want to say marginal, but I just want to say comparatively, they're not quite in the same echelon as, again, the no-brainers, Mike Schmidt, Carlton Fisk, George Brett. Go back to the golden era of baseball. Tim Raines is not Joe DiMaggio or Mickey Mantle or Ted Williams, So when we kind of have that soft spot for the guys who are really, 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 really good and we open the door, then others are going to come in. And I'm not saying Tim Raines was the first, but I said then, and I still believe it now, one of the big reasons why Tim Raines was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame is because of his years with the Montreal Expos. And there's a love for the Expos. There's an affinity for the Expos. We see it in other sports. People still wear Hartford Whalers jerseys. People still track down Seattle Pilots baseball caps, Brooklyn Dodgers, this, that, and the other. Atlanta Thrashers in the NHL, Supersonics of Seattle in the NBA. People still have connections to teams that are no longer existing. And because there was a passion for the Expos, but a whole lot of other problems that caused their movement from Montreal to Washington, D.C. after the 2004 season, And by the way, I don't think Montreal is getting a Major League Baseball team anytime soon. But because there's this longing for the Expos, and there was a big, very celebrated PR campaign to get Tim Raines into the Hall of Fame, I think that's one of the big reasons why he was there. He certainly, on his merits, was in the discussion for many years. I always thought he'd be one of those guys that was kind of in the 65 to 74% voting range with the Baseball Writers Association. I thought had the writers not voted him in, the Veterans Committee eventually would have. And, you know, I said that still, I think, because people just love to put on the old tricolor, or should I say tricolor hat, and talk about Gary Carter and Andre Dawson and Steve Rogers and, you know, Tim Wallach and everybody else who played for the Expos at some point in time. Because people get nostalgic for the Expos, and because Tim Raines was close but not close enough to get into the Hall, I think that's a big reason why he got into the Hall of Fame. Yeah, he did a lot on the field to warrant the discussion, but it was the love for the Expos, I think, that pushed him across the finish line. So mark my words, had Harold Baines ever played for the Montreal Expos, or had Harold Baines ever played for the Boston Red Sox or the New York Yankees, mark my word, there would be a whole lot less belly aching about Baines' induction into Cooperstown. Mark my word. If Baines played for Montreal, wore Yankee pinstripes, or was hitting, you know, balls over the Green Monster with a regular vengeance as a member of the Boston Red Sox, there would be a whole lot less outrage over this whole stinking thing. And even if you're a fan of the Yankees or the Red Sox or you like the Expos, I don't, you know, take away the statistics of Harold Baines' career. If he was a player on one of those three teams, your favorite team, you would be perfectly fine with his induction. And if you say, no, that's not the case, BS. I'm throwing the BS flag on you because it is, and it would be. So keep that in mind. Now, the other side of this coin, and I'm going to send out this warning shot because it may affect the Baseball Writers Association selections that will be announced in a few weeks, or it may affect future inductions, whether it's through the Writers Association or the Veterans Committee. But if you are a fan of Edgar Martinez being in the Baseball Hall of Fame, you cannot be a critic of Harold Baines being in the Hall of Fame. You can have one, you can't have the other. Because I think Baines' induction, as well as Raines, opens the door for a guy like Edgar Martinez to get in. Now, I've been a big champion of Edgar Martinez. I think he is certainly worthy of the discussion. I think he only gets in on a weaker ballot. But I still think he's kind of in that 65 to 74% range, much like he was, what do you get, 70.3% of the vote? So excruciatingly close. And I'm a big fan of Edgar because, you know, if it wasn't for Ken Griffey Jr., Edgar Martinez would be Mr. Mariner. And hey, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe despite Ken Griffey Jr.'s time up there, Edgar Martinez is Mr. Mariner. You know, if you're a Mariners fan or you lived in Seattle when he played there, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm totally fine with that. But we all know the story of Edgar Martinez. And the biggest knock on him was, well, he was a DH for most of his career. Well, yeah, he was. But a lot of people overlook the fact that he was a DH for most of his career. After being an all-star third baseman, he shredded his knee, I think it was 1992, in spring training. And in order to keep playing, and certainly the Mariners didn't want to lose his bat, he had to accept the role of the designated hitter. And it's something that he did extremely well for the remainder of his career. And you look at Edgar Martinez's stats, and some of the traditional stats don't line up with Harold Baines or Tim Raines. And I'm sure there are some advanced statistics that do, that do put him in that same class. But I truly believe that if you're just dead set against Harold Baines being in Cooperstown, you can't have Edgar Martinez in Cooperstown. I'm sorry. That's just how it is. That is the most hypocritical stance. If you go, Harold Baines is garbage, he can't go in there, but hey, yay Edgar, let's go. You can't do that. And this again opens up the slippery slope conversation. Well, now who else gets in? Who else had a pretty darn good career and deserves at least a good look? Well, all you have to do is, if you go to baseballreference.com, look at the similar scores of Raines and Baines. And I absolutely love the similar scores metric. It's not necessarily anything new. Bill James actually basically came up with a formula for it. And kudos to baseballreference.com for acknowledging that, well, it isn't necessarily their original idea. They got it from Bill James. But you look at Tim Raines' stats. He is up there with current Hall of Famers Lou Brock and Max Carey, Fred Clark, and Ina Slaughter. But who are some of the players who are in that same class, career-wise, who aren't in the Hall of Fame? Number two on that list, Kenny Lofton. Kenny Lofton. Ask yourself, be honest with yourself here. Does Kenny Lofton belong in the Baseball Hall of Fame? No, I'm not feeling it. And again, pretty good career. Great career war. Had over 2,400 hits, 622 stolen bases, career batting average of .299. Pretty darn good. But, meh. Johnny Damon. That's another one. Got to see Johnny Damon and what he could do to a team here in Tampa Bay with the Rays about, what was it, 10 years ago? 10 years ago. It was 2011, that's right. Johnny Damon, 18 years, 2,769 hits, career batting average of .284, career war lower than Kenny Lofton, of course, two-time champion with the Red Sox. Johnny Damon, a Hall of Famer? Eh. Julio Franco, even though he may have been playing in the major leagues at the age of six, we're not really sure. But Julio Franco, over 2,500 hits, almost 1,200 RBI, career on-base percentage, .365, batting average, .298. Julio Franco in the Hall of Fame? Eh. And you could do the same thing with Harold Baines. All right, I've already put up the argument that Harold Baines should be in there. So let's use the baseballreference.com/Bill James comparative stats here. Similar scores for career numbers. Let me pull them up here. So current Hall of Famers who have similar scores to Harold Baines, Tony Perez, Al Kaline, Billy Williams, Andre Dawson, that's pretty good company. Actually kind of buffets my argument why Baines should be in the Hall of Fame. But the number three player on that list, the Cobra, Dave Parker. I think Dave Parker should be in the Hall of Fame. That was a guy who not only did it offensively, but we all know about the cannon of an arm he had. Dwight Evans, I've heard a lot of people belly aching about Dwight Evans, and I believe them. I agree with them. Dwight Evans should definitely be a candidate. Rusty Staub? Probably not. God rest his soul. Had a great career. But again, you got the Montreal Expos angle there. Luis Gonzalez? Tampa kid. Loved Luis. Probably doesn't make the list. Torrey Hunter? Another Bay Area guy. Good player. Hall of Famer? Not thinking so. But some of these names that I've mentioned, when you let in a guy like Raines and a guy like Baines, who is similar to Raines, they're going in, temper your anger when the guys like Kenny Lofton or Luis Gonzalez or Julio Franco are voted in, be it current Baseball Writers Association or in many cases the Veterans Committee, but also celebrate if a guy like Edgar Martinez does get in, and people can overlook the stigma of being a DH for much of your career. Larry Walker as well, Todd Helton too, and I really think Dave Parker should be in there as well, as Dwight Evans. But that's one reason why I think you've got to temper your anger. First of all, because again, in the grand scheme of things, it's just the Hall of Fame, all right? Let's calm down here. We're not arguing the merits of should Pete Rose get into the Hall of Fame. And by the way, I do think he's going to get into the Hall of Fame, but only after he's dead. I hate to sound morbid, but we all know the only thing that matters to Pete Rose is Pete Rose. And the only way that I think they'll honor Pete Rose for his on-the-field achievements is when he is long buried and underground for several years. It's cruel, but I think that's exactly what they're all going to do. But, you know, the crux of my argument again is, you know, if Tim Raines is good enough to get in, and I thought he was good enough to be in the conversation to be considered, Harold Baines is in that boat as well. I think, you know, if you're going to let in Raines, you need to let in Baines, even though he didn't play for the Expos or the Red Sox or the Yankees. But be prepared. Those of you that were celebrating the Tim Raines induction a couple years ago, be prepared when that Kenny Lofton talk comes around, or the Julio Franco, or, you know, some of the names I mentioned before, because it is going to happen. So yeah, I do think there are a bunch of players who are worthy of, if not getting in, at least getting back into the conversation. And you think of Will Clark, Fred McGriff too, have been banging that drum for years, and, you know, this is the last year he's on the writer's ballot. You know, Larry Walker's another one, and, you know, I mentioned, you know, Dwight Evans, Lou Whitaker. We've talked endlessly about on this podcast, especially recent episodes. But, you know, I think that if you want these other players in, and there's certain stats and metrics that say, yes, they should be in, then you need to temper the anger over Harold Baines. Harold Baines, whether you like it or not, is a Hall of Famer. I think he's deserved of it. I think he's in the same class as some of the other current Hall of Fame players. Maybe not up there with the no-brainers, like I mentioned before, you know, Brett and Nolan Ryan and all those guys. But he's in there with other guys with similar numbers, with similar legacies, and he is well-deserved of it. By the way, one last note on Harold Baines before we look at the ballot for 2019 and also look at some of the 85 Topps cards here. Harold Baines was actually scouted by Bill Veeck when Baines was a little leaguer. Isn't that something? He was a first-round draft pick, first overall, by the White Sox back in 1977. And Veeck was scouting him out, oh, I think, when he was 12 years old. How cool is that? It's always fun when you can link up any story to the late, great, and somewhat zany Bill Veeck. Now, briefly on the ballot this year, I actually had somebody ask me, you know, who do I think gets in? And I'm looking at the first-year guys. Mariano Rivera, that's a no-brainer. He gets in. And there have been some stories that, you know, Rivera may be the first unanimous selection. Don't know if he'll be unanimous. There's always one or two knuckleheads that don't vote him first. But certainly, if he's not the highest vote-getter, he will be top three, perhaps, after an outstanding career. So, yeah, Mariano Rivera, that's a no-brainer. After that, I think Roy Halladay gets in. I think there's a little bit of a sympathy vote there, too. But no doubt that he was dominant for some average Blue Jays teams and helped deliver a World Series to Philadelphia when he was there. And then after that, it's hard to predict. I'm looking at some of the names, and, you know, Andy Pettit. Statistics alone tell you Andy Pettit should get there. But the steroid background and the allegations, Andy Pettit is probably 65-70% of the vote. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets in, but I also wouldn't be surprised if he's not here this year. I think the same kind of falls in play for Lance Berkman. And Todd Helton, of course, all his years in Colorado, that's going to go against him, which I think is unfair. But as for everybody else, I'm really not a big fan of the other first ballot players. Some of the other players, I mentioned Edgar Martinez. This is the final year that he's eligible through the writer's vote. He got 70.4% of the vote last year. So that could go either way. He could finally get that last 4.6% and get in. Or he could lose 4.6% and he misses with like 65% of the vote. I've been pulling for Edgar Martinez. I hope he makes it. I've been pulling for Fred McGriff. I don't think he's going to make it, unfortunately. He only pulled 23% of the vote last year. And Larry Walker, I think, is kind of in the same boat there. He's got two more years on the writer's ballot, only 34% of the vote. Everyone's criticizing him for playing in Denver like it's his fault that the stadium's 5,100 feet above sea level. And then as for the other returnees, if there's anybody who makes it, boy, it's a coin toss. It'll either be Mike Mussina or Roger Clemens. Clemens, based on the numbers, deserves it, but we all know the steroid background there. Same thing with Mussina. But much like I said about Andy Pettitte, if one or both of those guys gets in on the writer's vote, I'm not surprised. And if they don't get in, I'm not surprised. That's a coin toss. As for other alleged, he said, tongue-in-cheek, steroid users, such as Manny Ramirez, Barry Bonds, Curt Schilling, Sammy Sosa, while there has been a softening on the stance against steroids by a lot of the writers, I just don't see them getting in. You know, you may see a couple of percentage points going these particular players' ways, but I don't see it. So if I had to guess the 2019 ballot, it's Mariano Rivera, no doubt. It's Roy Halladay, very likely. I think it's a possibility that you get Edgar Martinez and or Andy Pettitte in there. I think Martinez has a better chance than Pettitte. And then as your dark horse, maybe Clemens or Mussina, but it would take an awful lot of votes to go their way. And those are my thoughts. Now, as for 85 Tops, I enjoyed opening up the pack, even though it was a dud. If you didn't see the video, as I mentioned before, got some all-star cards, some all-star Hall of Fame players. Also got five manager cards. And again, when I was a kid, had I opened that pack, I still would have just loved opening up a pack of 85 Tops. But what a bummer. How do you get five manager cards in a 28 card cello pack? What a ripoff. No wonder why you people didn't vote for it. But 85 Tops is a fun set to open up. You could argue it is the worst of the three sets produced that year. A lot of people love 85 Donruss. A lot of people love 85 Fleer. Tops not so much, although I don't think it's a bad set. I've always liked it for its quirkiness. I've called it the Cyndi Lauper of baseball cards. It's a very unusual look to it. With a prominent white border around the front side, the name of the team tilted on a little bar. You have a team logo in a circle, and you have the player name and position written underneath it. So it's a very MTV, Duran Duran, View to a Kill, New Coke kind of look. It's definitely 1985. And as I've mentioned before, one of Topps' goals for many years, in fact, I think it's still part of their mission, is to make cards look like the era that they were printed in, you know, represent the era. And this is a very We Are the World, Live Aid kind of look to it. Back to the Future, flux capacitor type stuff. Huey Lewis in the News, you name it. There's a whole lot of pop culture when you look at an 85 Topps card. So, I think it lived up to that. One of the downsides, though, is the backside of the card. What makes it unique also makes it very hard to read, and that is the choice of colors for the back. You've got the gray cardstock along with what I call the ectoplasm green backdrop and the pink text. Again, very Miami Vice. It's a 1985 look here, but very hard to read. A lot of people don't like it, and if you ended up with one of those cards that ended up with a little ink smudge on it, Yeah, it doesn't look good. It really doesn't. So that's one of the downsides, although very quirky and unique. It's not very popular. But the 85 top set is very popular. Of course, the Mark McGwire rookie card with the Olympic team from 1984, the big one. Also Roger Clemens, Kirby Puckett, some top rookies. You've got the second year Don Mattingly. And you also have a lot of early career cards for some of the stud young players. Of course, Sandberg and Boggs and Gwynn and Ripken and Henderson. All the big names of the 1980s, if they started in the earlier part of the decade, you're going to find their card in 1985. One of the glorious things about 85 Tops is, even though you do have a good rookie class and you do have some star power, it's still very affordable. Actually has been for a very long time. You can get wax packs for a decent price, you know, anywhere from $5 to $10 a pop. You can get cello packs for a decent price. In fact, this cello pack I got in a cello pack lot. I'm trying to remember what the other packs were. I think I had an 82 and an 83 in it, or maybe it was 83, 84, 85. I think that might have been what it was. But anyways, it was a combination pack I got on eBay with shipping. I think it was $15. So, of course, you get what you pay for with the five dreaded manager cards inside. But still, like any old wax, it's fun to open up here. And it is a relatively easy set to buy because once you get past the star cards and the star rookie cards, if you will, getting commons are pretty easy. This is before the true junk wax era of the hobby, but you still have plenty of commons out there that you can buy for a penny a piece off of many card collectors or sellers that are out there. So if you're looking for a fun project, 85 Tops is one of them. And even some of the big name cards that I mentioned are still affordable. You can still get McGwire rookie cards ungraded for under $20. You can still get Clemens and Puckett cards ungraded for under $10. In fact, Kirby Puckett I bought at a card show, I think, for $6. And if I were to look at it, I don't think it's a PSA 10, but it's certainly an 8.5 or above, and was worth every penny that I paid for it. Now, some of the cards that we found in this pack, real briefly, some interesting names once you got past all the managers. Well, let's start off with the one manager slash coach that was interesting, Raoul Rod Dedeaux, who was, as I mentioned at the start of the podcast, a longtime coach for the USC Trojans. What I thought was interesting about his career was not only some of the pro players that he mentored at USC, including Mark McGwire, but also Tom Seaver, Randy Johnson, Fred Lynn, or Dave Kingman as well, some not quite as well-known players, but pretty good, darn good major league players, Ron Fairley, Roy Smalley, Steve Kemp, Don Buford, all coming through USC. He coached the Trojans to five consecutive College World Series titles in the early 1970s, has all sorts of facilities on the USC campus named after him, and unfortunately passing away at the age of 91 back in January of 2006. Now, one other interesting story about his career, he played only one game with the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1935. He went 1-for-4 at the plate in his pro career, and he cracked his vertebrae while swinging his bat in cold weather. He had very brittle bones, and this actually happened the following year, 1936. He's playing for Dayton in the Mid-Atlantic League. So, and I stand corrected, he appeared in two games with Brooklyn in 1935. So after playing two games, having a .250 batting average, driving in a run as well, he goes to Dayton the following year, cracks that vertebrae. His playing career is over. So he becomes a coach, starting off in the semi-pro levels, but then basically becomes the head coach of USC starting in 1951. And it's amazing the players that he met along the way, the people that he touched along the way, but he was also a consultant for the movie Field of Dreams. And He was once an extra in the 1948 film The Babe Ruth Story, which was kind of a campy life story of Babe Ruth. So he didn't really like the phoniness of some Hollywood movies. So, you know, he added a lot of authenticity to Field of Dreams. And the director of Field of Dreams, Phil Alden Robinson, was talking about him, and he was talking to him, and he discovered the story of how Dedeau played only two games with Brooklyn, and his career ended the next year from some freak accident. And the director's like, holy crap, you're Moonlight Graham. Now, yeah, there was a real Moonlight Graham, but basically this guy pretty much lived out the Moonlight Graham storyline here of an opportunity missed, tragically missed, completely out of his control. But he was able to turn it around and you know, basically become a coach and mentor for the following almost 70 years of his life. So I thought that was really interesting how he was able to take tragedy and turn it into a positive. Now, a few other interesting names from the pack here. Bobby Meacham, who had a less than stellar career with the Yankees. In fact, George Steinbrenner didn't like him because he was often injured and he didn't quite live up to some of the promise that he had as a player. He is most notably known as the player that Steinbrenner and manager Billy Martin tried to prevent from being a witness to the birth of his first child during the 1985 season. He wants to, you know, be with his wife and you know, be there for the birth of their first child. And Martin and Steinbrenner actually tried to refuse giving him the day off to do that. So that added to the rather bad list of accomplishments that both Steinbrenner and Martin had in management and ownership of the New York Yankees. Meanwhile, while Meacham has not or did not live up to his playing career, he is moving up in the ranks of coaching, as he was a minor league coach with the Rockies and the Pirates for many, many years, was a first base coach in San Diego, you know, kind of bounced around from one organization to another, but started moving up the ladder in the Blue Jays organization, was manager in Dunedin in 2014, up to New Hampshire for a couple seasons after that, and since the start of the 2017 season, the manager in Buffalo, which is the AAA affiliate there. Now, one other note about Bobby Meacham, and I thought this was interesting, Bobby Meacham is a big, big reason why Tony Gwynn went to San Diego State University, but also why he played baseball at San Diego State. Meacham was at San Diego State at the exact same time. He used to play competitively against Gwynn in high school. And in fact, Meacham was the MVP for the Aztecs in 1979. And he was, according to the stories, the guy who basically helped recruit Gwynn for San Diego State and switched to baseball, or you know, succeed more in baseball after Gwynn came to San Diego State on a basketball scholarship. So even though Bobby Meacham may not have stood out on the playing field, he was certainly a key part of a future Hall of Famer's path to Cooperstown. Larry Herndon. Our Tigers fans are going to love Larry Herndon, who is often overlooked, as are many Tigers players, or by all the great players that played for Detroit during that 1984 World Series. Herndon, originally selected by the St. Louis Cardinals in 1971, one of his minor league roommates was Randy Poffo, a.k.a. Macho Man, Randy Savage. Always loved to tie in Randy Savage, you know, into baseball stories. Later would play for the San Francisco Giants, but made a name for himself as a member of the Tigers from 1982 to 1988. He is best known as the guy who caught the final out in the 1984 World Series between the Tigers and the Padres. And he is also known as one of only a handful of players to have hit home runs in four consecutive at-bats. He hit it in his final at-bat, May 17th, 1982, and then his first three at-bats, May 18th, 1982. So that's quite the feat. There also hit a key home run. It turned out to be the only run in the final game of the 1987 season, which helped the Tigers clinch a playoff spot over the Toronto Blue Jays at Tiger Stadium. Another interesting card, Ken Forsch. You may know Kenny's brother, Bob Forsch. Ken Forsch played for the Astros for much of his career, pictured here in the California Angels garb. That's where, or roughly around the time he was wrapping up his career. But he was a two-time All-Star. Bob Forsch also pitched for the Astros and pitched two no-hitters for the Cardinals. Meanwhile, Kenny Forsch pitching a no-hitter for the Astros against the Atlanta Braves in 1979. So, a unique trivial tidbit here. Ken Forsch, Bob Forsch, the only set of brothers to pitch no-hit, no-run games in Major League history. How about that? And lastly, Ron Darling, you know, if you've watched television any time in the last 20 years, you've certainly heard or seen Ron Darling, as he's been a frequent contributor as a color analyst, as a studio host, you name it. Ron Darling has probably said something to you while you've been watching a game on television. Of course, Ron Darling, best known for his time with the New York Mets, started Game 7 of the 86 World Series, and also memorably was part of Saturday Night Live a couple of weeks after the Mets won the World Series. Why is that? Because the legendary historical Game 6 marathon game between the Red Sox and Mets at Shea Stadium, that game was played on a Saturday night. NBC was broadcasting it, and the game ran so long that NBC decided not to run Saturday Night Live. It was just too late to try to start it up at, you know, 12:45 in the morning or whenever Game 6 ended. So a couple of weeks later, the Saturday Night Live show that was preempted basically got underway, and Ron Darling was part of the opening scene basically apologizing on behalf of the Mets for having that episode delayed. Oops. But, you know, Ron Darling had a, you know, career that was pretty average when you look at the numbers, but part of that memorable 86 team. Also an All-Star for the Mets in 1985. Gold Glove winner and a hell of a hitter, too. He hit home runs in two consecutive starts and was often used as a pinch runner by Davey Johnson in his time with the Mets. So there you go. Some interesting cards and an otherwise not so interesting pack of 85 tops. But if you do get the opportunity, whether it's a cello pack or several wax packs, again, they are affordable. And that is a fun and affordable project for a set that, again, doesn't quite get the respect that it's due. It's a good but not great set, but comes from a great time in baseball. Some great rookies and stars and Hall of Fame caliber players within that 792 85 top set. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program, not only looking back at the 85 top set and the pack and some of the strange cards we got out of it, but also my discussion on the Hall of Fame. Whether you agree that Harold Baines should be in the Hall of Fame or not, dial it back a little bit, all right? It's okay. Sun's still going to rise in the east tomorrow. It's all right if Harold Baines is in the Hall of Fame. You'll live. But also remember, when others that are in that same Baines and Reigns boat start getting inducted, don't get angry, even if that player happens to be your favorite longtime designated hitter, or once wore the Montreal Expos uniform, or pinstripes, or Red Sox cap, whatever the case may be. If you would like to make a donation to Wax Ecstatic, you could do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Our next show coming up 2 weeks from now. That will be Friday, December the 28th. Until then, have a very Merry Christmas, a happy holiday season, and a Festivus for the rest of us. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.